Spoken several times today, Mr. Jefferson, about the rights of the people and the need to disrupt their government, and yet the government you gave us was more of a republic, and I speak to such things as the Electoral College. Do you see the government, or did you see the government at that time as a true democracy, or was this more of a noblesse oblige?
Well, these are three very different things. First, you talk about protest, and I think no matter what your system is, monarchy, oligarchy, aristocracy, mixed system, whatever social compact you devise, there still is a sacred right of protest, that any human being has a right to go into the public square and say, I profoundly disagree with X. And if you don't cherish that, you are not an enlightened people. An enlightened people cherishes discontent and cherishes protest, no matter what the system. So that's number one. Number two, it's true we're not a democracy, we're a republic, and that's how most of the founding fathers intended it. And by republic we mean that you are sovereign, but your sovereignty is filtered and refined through certain systems, an electoral college, a system of representation, the House is different from the Senate, there's the state versus the federal authority. You have a set of disciplinary distillation systems which take your general will and distill it into public action. Ours is a republic. I would have gone closer to democracy. Someone like Hamilton would have gone farther away from democracy. So we have this compromise republic. I think it's in your interest in the 21st century to move more completely towards democracy, but that's entirely up to you. The earth belongs to the living and not the dead. So it seems to me that it doesn't matter with respect to protest, what's the nature of your government. What the question I would ask you to ask yourselves is, do you think that the settlement that you have created, in which you distill your will, is working for you? Do you believe that you are still in charge of your own destiny? Do you think that your taxes are being wisely spent and that you have some control over how that works? Do you believe that your representatives are responsive to your needs? Do you believe that your government reflects the general will of the American people? If you believe those things, you should have a modest vote of confidence for this system. If you despair about that, then you should regain control of your own destiny as peacefully as possible and as bloodily as required.
Yeah, there you go with that pitchfork thing again. You know, it's sort of like we've got, it's like somebody who has a job that they kind of love, they kind of don't like, but it's making them enough money that they're too comfortable to take a step back and do anything about it. You know, you talk to some people and say, well, I don't like my job, but I can't afford to leave it. I think we feel the same way about our government. We don't really like it. We think maybe it ought to be this or that, but we're too invested in this now to take a step back and start all over.
I think that's right. I think that's how you feel. You are the most prosperous people who have ever lived on Earth. And that's extraordinary. You represent a certain percentage of the world's people. You consume a certain percentage of the world's resources. If all the world lived as you do, the world probably couldn't sustain that economically or environmentally or socially. So you are in a uniquely fortunate moment. You are living with special privilege. Maybe you have earned it as a people. I dare say you have, but you are the world's exemplar of a mass luxurious consumerist society. And everyone else is looking from the outside in with envy, a desire to join you, dislike of you for what you control, and I think that you are so addicted to your comforts that you would rather be comfortable than free. And I think you're saying to your government, doesn't really matter if it's Tweedledee or Tweedledum, just keep it coming. In the history of the world, I don't mean to sound negative, because as you know, I lived a life of extraordinary luxury, and I had all the books that I wanted and all the scientific instruments, and I bought wine that I couldn't afford, and I rebuilt Monticello many times, and I died $104,000 in debt, which would be about $8 million in your currency. So I'm not exactly the example of the modest family farmer living in the wilderness. I get it, so please don't accuse me of hypocrisy. I'm just confessing to that. But if you look at history, all great republics have had a kind of voluntary simplicity and almost a voluntary poverty. And luxury being dependent on foreign commodities, wanting your stuff so much that you sort of go to sleep about liberty and good government, that has inevitably in history been the collapse of a system. You're living, maybe you can sustain this for 100 more years, but all historical cultures that have become like yours have collapsed from addiction to luxury.
On that happy note, we'll take, and I must say, I think you've got it. I think that rings true, and that's scary, what you've just said.
It's not so scary, you know. It's scary because you're addicted, as I was. But you could recover. You know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could consume a little less, walk a little more. It's not out of the realm of possibilities that you could read a book and tone down your opulence. In other words, no one's suggesting that you live in a hut. If everyone in this room, with the exceptions of if there are poor people in the room, and there may be, but if everyone who's middle class or above voluntarily reduced their consumerism and their materialism by 10%, no one would suffer for one second, and I believe each one of you would be happier.
If we would, yeah.
10%. We're not talking about selling off your SUV.
Today's society has a rabid fascination with celebrity. What are your thoughts on that, and who was the Paris Hilton of your day?
This kind of dovetails nicely with what he just said.
What a pleasant question. Thank you very much. You know, this Miss Hilton looks emaciated to me. You know, Dolly Madison was sort of the great woman of my time, and she was a buxom woman, and she had some flesh. And we liked our women to have flesh, because women do. You know, that if there were no style, if there were only people living in a state of nature, there would be no Paris Hilton. That in a state of nature, humans accumulate a little body mass. And this is essential to childbearing. If you look at it from an anthropological point of view, it's been essential through history that desirable women look more like Dolly Madison than like this young lady. And so this is another sign of a very advanced culture moving towards decadence when you privilege what in my time would have been seen as someone close to the level of starvation.
Yeah.
So you need to readjust and get back to nature, because nature teaches us how the body should be. Nature teaches us how humans should behave. Who is the Paris Hilton of my time? Anne Willing Bigham was America's most celebrated beauty. She was an extraordinarily beautiful woman and a society hostess, but you've never heard of her. Dolly Madison probably was the most publicly visible figure of the early 19th century. She was a very extraordinary woman. But I'll tell you what she had that this Miss Hilton does not. She had a mind. And a mind in a woman is much more alluring than a perfect form. We did have a cult of celebrity to a certain point. You know, Meriwether Lewis was a celebrity when he came back from the American West, and it went to his head, and he drank too much, and he died tragically young. Aaron Burr was a sort of celebrity. I suppose I was a sort of celebrity. Anyone who gets to a certain level of political prominence becomes a kind of celebrity, and part of the attention is no longer about what you do, it's about the fact that you are. I tried to be as quiet and retired as it's possible to be. In fact, there's a famous story about this. I was in a carriage going from one American city to another, and I always traveled, even as president, very quietly. No, I called no attention to myself. I didn't have presidential luggage and presidential insignia and so on. And I was simply sitting in this carriage, and a farmer got in, and we started to talk, and he started to abuse the president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. He said that Jefferson was an atheist, and Jefferson was a French ideologue, and Jefferson's principles were touched by fanaticism, and that his fiscal policies were all in error. And I listened very quietly and just drew him out and didn't say a word. And the next day, we met at breakfast, and he realized that I was the president of the United States. And he was so embarrassed. He was so ashamed that he had spoken this way. And I went up and I took his hand. And I said, you have given me the greatest of all gifts. You have spoken to me as an honest human being. You haven't been intimidated by the fact that I'm the president. The president should be a citizen. You know, you and I are equal. I happen to have been entrusted with this power. But that doesn't make me king. It doesn't make me majestic. It doesn't make me better than you. It makes me have a different job portfolio. And if I can get you to speak honestly about your opinions of me, I have gained something that I could never get from all the flatterers and toadies of the world.
Hmm. That's well put. I think she was wondering, you know, who would be on the cover of People magazine, 1780, and Jefferson just isn't exactly got the sizzle that they want to have to move the unit, you know?
I'm not sure that's true. I don't think that's true, because I would like to be pictured with I invented a plow, for example.
I mean, I'm sorry, that...
If there had been a magazine in the Enlightenment that celebrated something,
yeah,
it wouldn't have been somebody who's never, I mean, I suppose that one could ask, what has Miss Hilton done to ameliorate the condition of mankind?
No, we don't even know what she does, period.
I invented this plow. It's the moldboard of least resistance.
Okay.
And if I could show you on this
chalkboard. Yeah, go ahead. Take your time. It's no rush.
But the plow, you know, plowing lifts the earth and turns
right.
It. It's a very crude instrument. And so when you take a plow, you're effectively dragging it through the earth. If you get the plowshare right, you reduce to a statistical minimum the friction of plowing. There is one and only one statistically perfect plowshare. I saw a peasant plowing in Europe, and I realized this could be done through mathematics. So I sat down in the furrow with him and took out a tablet, and using calculus, which had been simultaneously invented by Leibniz and Newton, called fluxions in my time, I happened to know calculus, so I worked out the moldboard of least resistance. I came back and had it built in wooden prototype, and it reduced the labor of plowing by 37%.
Hmm.
And in your day, if you go to an agricultural college and say, show me the perfect plowshare, they will have no choice but to bring out mine. Not because of me, but because there is one and only one perfect plowshare, and math and science can teach us what it is, and Paris Hilton doesn't know what a plow is.
Just finish, if you would, with, because we've talked around the Declaration, we haven't actually lived with the words for a moment. Would you just share with us something that you wrote?
You know, it was this early summer of 1776, and I've told you how the committee devolved down to John Adams, Dr. Franklin, and myself, and I've told you why Franklin chose not to write the Declaration of Independence. And then John Adams came to my boarding house in Philadelphia on Market Street, and he said he was 8 years older than I was, and he was much more important in the Revolution than I was. You know, I was a latecomer and a very retired, shy, scholarly fellow. Adams had been right at the center of it. We probably wouldn't have had the Revolution when we did if it hadn't been for John Adams. So I respect that. And he came to me and he said, Mr. Jefferson, you must write this document. And I said, why? And he said, three reasons. First, you are a Virginian, and a Virginian must be at the head of this business. Second, I, John Adams, am disliked and obnoxious. And if I write this document, it will not have credibility. And third, he said, you write 10 times better than I do. So I was very reluctant, because this is a grave moment. But I agreed to do it, and I wrote my first draft in a single afternoon, consulting neither book nor pamphlet. I simply wrote out the common sense of the subject, what any one of you would have written had you been called upon to do it. I'm serious, that this was an expression of the American mind. This wasn't a time for me to invent anything. It was a time for me to articulate certain principles that are in the heart of mankind. And so most of the Declaration of Independence, the part that really mattered in my time, the part that was read and debated, was the 18-point indictment of George III in the Parliament of England, you know, quartering troops in our houses without our consent, stirring up Indians to attack us in the West, taking people accused of crimes here and trying them not amongst their peers in America, but off in England by star chamber courts. And we had a long list of abuses that had thrown us into revolution. That's the part that mattered in my time. No one reads that in your time. No one on the 4th of July reads through that list. It's seen as dull. But it was cutting-edge revolutionary talk in my time because we were justifying why we were doing this thing. So that's where the attention was. And the first, the famous preamble, which you're pointing to, was in some sense Enlightenment boilerplate. You know, you say certain things that everyone agrees upon, self-evident truths, to get to the indictment. So it was really a preface, but you're pointing to the famous sentence, which I will admit is probably the most important sentence in the English language. Not because I wrote it, not at all, but because it's true, because it's written in the breast of man. So what did I say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the sentence. Here's why I'm standing here today. Not because I was the brightest of the Founding Fathers, I wasn't. Not because I was the most profound thinker of the Founding Fathers, that was Madison. I'm standing here because I could write that way. Because let me just give you quickly what I think that sentence might have been had others written it. If George Washington, the greatest man of my time, had written it, what would he have said? "We're tired of England, we quit." That's not enough. It's blunt and to the point, and it gets the job done, but it's not enough. What if John Adams had written it? Adams should have written it. I mean, I wanted him to write it, and he was certainly fitted for it. But he couldn't have written that sentence because, and I don't mean this by way of sarcasm, but his Declaration of Independence would have been a very long pamphlet. It would have been an endless document, fascinating, but not much to the point. If you look at his books, which have been saved, he defaced all of his books. He did. His books are filled with marginalia. So if you open one of his books, all along the margins in every corner are John Adams quibbling with the author. Long rants against the arguments and saying, "I should have done this. I could have done it better." And all this, his books are just ruined by this. I had 7,000 books, and if you go to see those that are left in the Library of Congress, I never wrote in any book in my entire life except two things. There were signatures. This is the way books were bound. They were bound by something called signatures. And on the one that had T, it goes A, B, C, D, all the way through, every fifth or 12th or 16th page, on the one that said T, I would put in pencil TJ. That's it. I would find the T signature in a book. It might be on page 80, it might be on page 800, but I would put TJ. And that's how they can find my books when they turn up at auctions. And secondly, the only other defacing that I ever did in a book in my whole life is if the Latin sentence was wrong, I would correct it quietly. You know, if there was a punctuation error, I would put a little pencil mark. My books are pristine, they're beautiful. Adams are travestied by his own, you know, ebullience. Here's what I think he would have said. "We feel reasonably certain that under certain carefully controlled social and political circumstances, most white males of a certain property base can be regarded as equal in some limited respects." See footnotes. And he would have been more accurate than I. But when you have your founding moment, when you're creating the world's most extraordinary republic, a utopia, you want a dreamer at the center of that business.
Thomas Jefferson.